Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I don't know. How the hell do you lose this election, right?
President Trump sets his sights on 2020 in Florida. We're joined by the state's Republican Senator Rick Scott. Then, the Arab world's first freely elected president dies on trial. What Mohamed Morsi's fate tells us about Egypt and democracy. Plus,
you can't just walk up to a Muslim girl and like start spitting game or something. What am I supposed to say? Like, hey, can I get your father's number?
Yes, why not?
Comedian Rami Youssef tells our Hari Srinivasan how his new series connects his Egyptian roots to his American life. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Campaign season is well and truly open in the United States as President Trump officially enters the ring, releasing this video and launching his re-election bid tonight in the key swing state of Florida. But even as he whips up his base with his tried and true promises to deport millions of immigrants, he's also stoking a serious threat of conflict in the Persian Gulf. The United States says it will send 1,000 additional troops and more military resources to the Middle East as hostility grows with Iran after attacks on shipping, the latest in the Gulf of Oman. But this is what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo cautioned today.
President Trump does not want war, and we will continue to communicate that message while doing the things that are necessary to protect American interests in the region.
Pompeo was talking to the military there. So how will international crises like these impact President Trump's bid for re-election? Joining me now is Florida's Republican senator and former governor, Rick Scott. A growing voice on American foreign policy, he's also one of a trio of senators chosen by the president to lead the Republican effort for a new health care plan. So welcome to the program, Senator.
It's nice. Congratulations on your show.
Well, thank you, Senator. And it's great to have you because, you know, as I said, the president is re-entering the race for re-election, obviously, in your state. I guess I need to ask you, though, how come, you know, his own popularity, according to his own internal polling, is a little lower than maybe all of you would like to see, given the strong numbers on his performance on the economy and other such issues? People have said those two facts shouldn't be in the same sentence.
Well, I've been in one primary and three general elections, and the polls always would show me losing. They never showed that I would win. So the only poll that really matters is on election day. And I think what he's got to do is he's got to talk about his successes. The economy's on fire. He's going to Florida, my home state, where our unemployment, when I left, was down to 3.3%. Very few people are on unemployment benefits. So he's got to talk about that. He's got to talk about the other thing that's important to people is American security, whether you're talking about the crisis on the border or dealing with Iran or China, North Korea. He's got lots of issues out there, and he's got to talk about what he's doing to try to make sure that Americans are safe. Those are the two most important issues to Floridians right now.
I know you're concentrating on Floridians, but if I just might ask you to put your expert hat on, in Texas, not far from your state, half the voters say they won't vote for him. And also, he seems to be, again, according to their own internal polling, trailing Joe Biden in key swing states. I guess the question is, why wouldn't this president be cruising to re-election?
You know, I'm not much of a pundit. I can talk about Florida. I know, you know, these elections are hard. You've got to get out there and you got to tell your story. You got to go convince people that you're going to solve their personal problems. Think about what people are doing. They're saying, if you get their vote, they're saying, you are going to be better for my family than the alternative. And that's what the president's got to say. He's got to say, the economy's better because of the actions I've taken to reduce taxes and reduce regulation. You're safer because the actions he's taken on North Korea and China and Iran and all these places. And so that's what he's got to go sell. And these races are going to be, it's hard to win. You've got to, my state's a 50-50 state. You've got to work your tail off to win. You've got to talk to everybody.
I'm going to come back to some of those very, very important security foreign policy issues in a second. But first, I just want to talk about something that's also, you know, important to Florida, and that's immigrants, migration, et cetera. And the president did, in fact, launch the campaign today by saying next week, ICE will begin the process of removing the millions of illegal aliens who've illicitly found their way into the United States. They'll be removed as fast as they come in. Mexico, using their strong immigration laws, is doing a very good job of stopping people. So obviously that's a little bit of a bone he's throwing to Mexico after that big sort of tariff war. But I guess, do you know of any plans for this mass deportation? Or is this, you know, just a slogan? How is ICE going to deport millions of people, Senator?
Christina, I've not been informed of this. We're an immigration state. We have 20% of my population in Florida speaks Spanish. We love legal immigration. We don't support illegal immigration. I've been frustrated. I've been frustrated while I was governor. I've been frustrated up here. Why don't we get something done? Why are the Democrats against securing the border? Why can't we, take care of the DACA children, deal with TPS, have a permanent solution for that, have a work visa program that works? All these things I know would be good for Florida. I think they'd be good for the country. So it's frustrating to me. It's one of my frustrations that, I'm a business guy, so you want to get things done. And right now, it's just up here, nothing's getting done.
Yeah, I wonder whether you see a time where you can actually re-engage with the Democrats and get this immigration reform done. Because there was a moment, and then it all went, belly up. There was a moment early in President Trump's first couple of years. Do you see that as a possibility, a proper bipartisan, mature deal for immigration reform, including DACA and the other things you mentioned?
I hope so. I think it'd be good for I know it'd be good for Florida. I think it'd be good for the country. We've got to have a secure border. And a lot of times what people want to do is just, they want to take care of their issue and nobody else's. So we've got to have a secure border. I went down right after I got elected to the border. There's a crisis. There's no question. I talked to President Trump yesterday. He was, my phone call, very complimentary on Mexico. He says they're actually showing up and reducing the number of people coming across our border, which I think is a real positive. But let's come up with real solutions. We've got a humanitarian crisis. We need to get the funding done to help the people that are in custody. I just don't get why we don't solve these problems. We know who doesn't believe we should take care of the DACA kids? Very few people don't want to take care of them. We know we have to solve TPS. It's a problem for my state, especially. We've got a lot of Haitians in my state. Why don't we have a permanent solution? So I'm going to work on it. I've been up here a little less than 6 months. I'm trying to build relationships, work hard, come up with ideas to try to get something that'll make it better for Americans and people that want to come here legally.
Well, that would be really interesting to see how that might happen in the next legislative cycle. But let me also...
I'm an optimist.
Good. Well, yes, but this is a massive issue, as you know better than I do.
Right.
But we watch it unfolding in these really, you call it a humanitarian situation. It is, but it's also very cruel. The separation of children, the fact that children are dying in custody. We've been exploring all of this on our program regularly. And everybody wants to see a great country like the United States be secure and have a rational immigration policy. So let's hope that that'll be the president's and your all motivation next time it comes around. But on healthcare, and this is another thing President Trump has said he wants, obviously a reform. He just told ABC in rather an interesting interview over many, many hours that he sat with George Stephanopoulos that he'll be announcing a new healthcare plan within the next few months. His exact words, we're going to produce phenomenal healthcare, and we already have the concept of the plan. So you are one of three Republicans who are named to figure this out, to the healthcare plan. What does he mean?
Well, I haven't seen his plan. I'm very optimistic that we'll be able to come up with a solution. I came out of the healthcare industry. I ran the largest at the time hospital company in the country. The problem with healthcare is it costs too much. whether it's prescription drugs cost too much, you get surprised with your medical billing. So my focus is going to be, how do we drive down the cost of health care? Because that's going to get people more health care. That's what my focus is. I grew up in a family. I lived in public housing. We didn't have health care insurance. I remember my mom crying because she couldn't get health care for her brother. So this stuff is very important to me. You need to be able to stay on your parents' plan. If you have a pre-existing condition, you've got to be able to continue to get health care. But we've got to figure out how to get health care prices down. I have a bill that would drive, that would say, why are Americans paying more than Europeans for prescription drug prices? That doesn't make any sense. When you go to the hospital, how can you be, you should not ever be surprised about your billing. And so I'm going to continue to push things like this to drive the cost down and more people have access to health care.
Senator, since you brought it up, I'm going to have to ask you. You talked about being an entrepreneur, that you were involved in running a health care provider. As you well know, some 15 years ago, while you were still in charge, although you yourself weren't charged, it pleaded guilty to massive Medicaid and Medicare fraud. So what do you say to people who say, well, maybe you might not be the best place to be leading this charge and leading the, you know, Republican panel on health care plans and reforms?
Sure. Well, I believe in accountability, and the company, you know, made sure that every dime was always paid back. I believe that's what you have to do as a CEO of a company. You take responsibility and you take charge and you make sure all the money was paid back. We did. I have been very focused my whole career on how you get people more health care. I did it as governor. We made sure our Medicaid plan worked. We controlled the cost, but made sure that somebody was responsible for your care. And I'll do the same thing with anything I'm involved in healthcare up here.
So let me ask you again on healthcare, because, again, a huge issue. And as you know, it played very, very strongly in the midterm elections. And one of the reasons, I guess, why Republicans haven't torpedoed the Affordable Care Act is because people actually protested that even that possibility in Republican town halls. Here's what I asked Valerie Jarrett, who's got a new book out. I interviewed her, and obviously I asked her about the Affordable Care Act because it was called Obamacare, and she was, you know, front and center in that administration as a senior advisor.
And you mentioned the Affordable Care Act. The reason why it is still the law of the land is because so many people came out and protested at town halls and sent a very strong message to their Republican leaders about how they felt about losing this important benefit.
So, I mean, that's a fact, and that was showed in the midterm elections. What do you have any plans that will make people not want to keep the Obamacare?
Well, for first, Christine, I couldn't hear what Valerie said.
What she said. The people at town hall sent a very strong message to their Republican leaders about how they felt about losing this important benefit.
Well, let's look at reality. Even the Democrats are trying to walk away from Obamacare. They're trying to get Medicare for all. So they know the problem with Obamacare is this. Premiums skyrocketed. Deductible skyrocketed. If you go before Obamacare was passed and said that a deductible is going to be $5,000, people say, oh, that's a catastrophic plan. That's commonplace now. So, and remember what President Obama said, every family's health care costs were going to go down, what, $2,500? It did the opposite. Premiums have skyrocketed. So we've got to go back and say, how do you drive the cost, the delivery cost of health care down? That's the problem we have. The cost of healthcare is too expensive. So that's what I'm going to continue to focus on. But Obamacare has not been a success. Premiums are up, copayments are up, deductibles are way up.
But the thing is, people voted on it, and they voted to keep it, and they voted because it covers existing conditions, it covers young people on their parents. So all of that. Anyway, I know we can have an argument about that.
But that's exactly right. We should make sure that you can still get health care if you have a pre-existing condition. We should make sure you can stay on your parents' plan. But to have these premiums skyrocket that they've done after Obamacare is not what the American public was promised.
Let us move on to a very urgent issue, and you sort of brought it up, and we talked about it, the escalation between Iran and the United States. I spoke to the Iranian ambassador in an exclusive interview. He was afraid that confrontation could happen. I spoke to Bill Burns, the former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, who, as you know, has been very closely involved in Iran diplomacy. And he said that there's a real problem because the United States hasn't built any kind of movement with allies. This is what he said.
The fact that the administration seems to be having such a difficult time persuading some of our closest allies of our case is a mark, I think, of how much our credibility has suffered and how much we've isolated ourselves since President Trump made the really unfortunate decision to abandon the comprehensive nuclear agreement.
So we have a situation here that's just sort of a vicious cycle. I don't know how you see it, but you just heard Secretary Pompeo said the president does not want war. What do you think the president's plan is? Have you seen a plan for this escalation?
Christiana, I could not hear what the individual said, but here's the way I look at it. Is it Iran or the United States that have gone after these ships? It's Iran. Is it Iran or the United States that are supporting groups like Hezbollah? It's Iran. So we sit there. I wish Iran would act responsibly and say they're not going to spread terrorism around the world. They're in Venezuela. Why are they in our hemisphere spreading problems? So I'm glad the president doesn't want to go to war. None of us want to go to war. But we can't sit there and have them chant death to America and think they're going to be our friend. Say they want to annihilate Israel and want to be our friend. So we've got to understand, we've got to stand up against Iran if they're going to do the bad thing. I hope they don't. I don't want to go to war. None of us want to go to war. But we can't let them go down this path. Oh, they're hurting the shipping channels, but somehow blame it on America. We didn't do that. They did.
Well, you see, here's the thing. The Europeans, who are your allies, who you would depend on for any, I guess, big action, say that actually it was the United States who violated the Iran nuclear deal by pulling out and not honoring the economic part that it had to play, as Iran is honoring its nuclear part. So this is a vicious cycle. And I just wonder whether you see an off-ramp here. But it's very clear what the Europeans believe. They say, let's put this in context. Whatever's happening down there, it is the United States that started this by violating its terms under the deal.
I think the difference is America made the decision not to stay as a member of that. The Europeans, to this date, I think, believe in it. So if that's good for the Europeans and good for Iran, they ought to comply with it. They don't need the Americans to be part of this. But the Iranians should not be one, developing a nuclear weapon. Number two, they also should not be doing these things in the ships that they're doing.
Yeah. As you know, the Europeans can't do their business because the U.S. has imposed secondary sanctions. But I want to move on to Venezuela because you are quite vocal about Venezuela. You've written an op-ed in which you say the U.S. military action in Venezuela may become a necessity. What is the trigger point for that? Do you believe in the Trump administration getting involved militarily in Venezuela?
Sure, you sure hope not. But I've been down to Cucuta. I've talked to the families down there. These kids are starving to death. We have an individual, Maduro, with the support of the Cuban government, that is basically killing children. I have grandchildren. I have a 3-year-old grandson. If he was living in Venezuela, his mom would be saying, I don't have food for you today. I'm going to give you some dirty water. Don't get sick because we don't have any medicine. And by the way, our hospitals are not open. They don't have the technology today to take care of you. That's going on. And it's going on because Maduro is doing it with the support of Cuba, Russia, China, Iran, Hezbollah, the ELN. So we have to deal with two things. We've got a genocide going on right now. And then if we don't deal with this issue, we're going to have the same, all the bad actors are there. We're going to have a Syria in our hemisphere. And so Maduro ought to step aside. Let's have free and fair elections. Cuba should, everybody ought to get out of there. Let the Venezuelans decide what their government's going to be. But Maduro had a fraudulent election. Everybody's agreed it was a fraudulent election. So step aside and do the right thing.
To be continued, these are very important points. Senator Rick Scott, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Now, Egypt has always been a key U.S. ally in the Arab world. On Monday, almost exactly 7 years since he became Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi collapsed and died in a glass cage standing trial on yet another raft of charges by the regime of President Sisi, who deposed and replaced him 6 years ago. State media reports Morsi had a heart attack. Denied a public burial in his own hometown, the 67-year-old Morsi was laid to rest this morning in Cairo with only a few family members present. According to one of his lawyers, he spent his last minutes in court testifying that he was still the legitimate president of his country. Human rights groups are calling for an independent investigation into the Egyptian government's treatment of Morsi in prison, arguing that he was not given the medical treatment he needed. We'll talk to our guest about what this says about democracy in Egypt, but let's first have a quick look back at the promise and the peril of Egypt's fight for freedom. Like so much of the Arab Spring history, Mohamed Morsi's tenure was punctuated by massive crowds in Egypt's famous Tahrir Square. The road to his presidency began in 2011, when these masses helped topple the three-decade rule of the strongman Hosni Mubarak, who would himself then spend years in prison. In 2012, Morsi was put forward as the Muslim Brotherhood candidate for president. Trained as an engineer, he was a complete unknown outside the country. I spoke to him at the time, and I asked him whether democracy and the rights of women would be respected.
Of course.
All right. Well, thank you for saying that in English. I hear you loud and clear. And all the Egyptian women are hoping that they will be respected and their rights will be guaranteed. So I guess now that I have you here, I just want you to say it loud and clear.
Yeah, loudly and clearly. All Egyptian women have the same rights like the men. They are all my sisters, my daughters, my wife and my mother. They are all Egyptians. There is no differences whatsoever among the people in Egypt, the people of Egypt, based on anything like belief or sex or whatever you call or you name.
Egyptians then cast their votes. For the first time, it was a truly democratic election. Mohamed Morsi will be and is the next president of Egypt. And I was there in Tahrir Square with my colleague Ben Wiedemann to witness that. He immediately resigned from the Muslim Brotherhood, and yet suspicions persisted. His critics say he did not maintain enough distance from the Brotherhood, but he also didn't fulfill some of the worst fears. He kept decent relations with the United States and with Israel, honoring the peace treaty signed at Camp David. But he presided over a chaotic and at times authoritarian administration. A year later, frustrated Egyptians again took to Tahrir Square, this time protesting against him. And that's when the military, led by his own defense secretary, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, intervened. At a Muslim Brotherhood rally, the military fired into the crowd and left at least 800 people dead. Morsi spent the rest of his life in prison. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi remains the president of Egypt. Now, these events all matter more because of Egypt's bellwether status. What happens there can be a sign of what's to come in the region. I'm joined now by the British lawmaker, MP Crispin Blunt, who led a government panel on the treatment of President Morsi last year.
Parliamentary panel.
Parliamentary panel. Hold on a second, I've still got to read your introduction. He was also the chair of the UK Foreign Affairs Select Committee. And he's joining me now, intervening, as we speak. Nonetheless, aptly corrected, a parliamentary panel. What exactly does that mean? Tell me about the parliamentary panel.
Well, I was asked to put a panel together to look at the conditions under which Mohamed Morsi was being detained. And I selected Lord Edward Foulkes to join me, who is a Conservative former Justice Minister. Certainly wouldn't be seen as a blanching liberal by any standards, and is also now a judge. And my Labour colleague, Dr. Paul Williams, who is a practising GP, continues to practice whilst he's in the House of Commons. But importantly, before coming into the House of Commons, he had inspected and checked victims of torture for as human rights organizations in the United Kingdom to validate their claims on medical grounds.
So you're claiming that the government of Egypt could be had up on torture charges?
Well, so what I then put together was what I thought was a panel that ought to give confidence to the Egyptians that we were going to do any review of his conditions fairly. Mm-hmm. As much as anything else, I hope it's an opportunity for them to obviously let us see the conditions, and if they were going to let us go and look, they might improve the conditions that were being reported to us, which was the cause of the inquiry in the first place. But we got no communication for our requests from the Egyptian government to go and have a look. So we then looked at all the evidence that was available to us remotely in order to put together our report, which we did in March 2018.
And we'll get to that, but you were slightly prescient because in March 2018, I mean, you wrote that unless things change, and I think you said it could lead to Morsi's death.
We did. No, we said that if his if he didn't continue not to receive the medical treatment he needed, and he continued to be held in what appeared to be, and on the evidence available to us, were the most demeaning, difficult conditions, 23 hours of solitude, very difficult for him to raise the to raise the attention of his warders if he was ill. There were occasions where he had gone into a diabetic coma whilst in the cell. No mattress, only two blankets to sleep on or around. And no proper communication. Three family visits in 6 years is woefully below any kind of international standard, below the standard any ordinary Egyptian in custody would expect. And for a former president of Egypt, indeed the only properly democratically elected president of Egypt, standards which I don't think reflects well on Egypt at all.
So do you are you calling for an independent investigation? Human Rights Watch is, other rights organizations?
I think so many people assessed the evidence of the conditions under which Mohamed Morsi was being held. We were not alone, but we came to a specific conclusion, carefully guided by a counsel to our inquiry, that the standards in which he was being held were so cruel and degrading that they could amount to torture. Torture is a crime of universal jurisdiction, and the responsibility for torture in those circumstances must go all the way up to the chain of command to the current head of state of Egypt. It is plainly the conditions under which Mohamed Morsi was being held in, and his health and everything else would have been of interest to the his successor as head of state.
Yeah, and as I said, Human Rights Watch says, I think there's a very strong case to be made that this was criminal negligence, deliberate malfeasance in providing Morsi basic prisoner rights. He was obviously singled out for mistreatment. This is the executive director for the region. Do you, though, think, I mean, let's face it, the current president who deposed Morsi, who was involved in, you know, backing up the anti-Morsi protesters, and who is now president, who was Morsi's defense secretary, has been welcomed in the White House. He's welcomed, obviously, in Saudi Arabia. He's part of the group of Arab countries who support the U.S. and a certain politics in that region. And that politics is, if anything, can be summed up as anti-Islamist and anti-Muslim brotherhood.
That's true, and there's obviously evidence about the involvement of some of those states who are, if you like, keenest on the anti-Islamist agenda, to some degree precipitating the difficulties that Mohamed Morsi found himself in towards the end of his time in government. But what is very disappointing is the reaction of the British government today, which appears to have said that its primary interest is calm and stability. Noting that Mohamed Morsi was a significant figure in Egypt's political history. Well, frankly, that really isn't good enough. This is the only person ever democratically elected president of Egypt in a properly contested election.
So how would you describe it? Let's just say what the, as I say, the Egyptian government says, no, he's a terrorist, he's an Islamist, he's a Muslim Brotherhood. We know that he stepped down from the Muslim Brotherhood immediately as he was elected, and he said over and over to me that there's not an Islamic democracy or a Muslim Brotherhood democracy. This is actually what he said, and then we'll talk about how he was charged afterwards.
There is no such thing called an Islamic democracy. There is democracy only, and democracy is the instrument that is present now. The people are the source of authority. The social mindset is there are a people and the people chooses. That's democracy, and that agrees with consultation called for in Islam. With that, we are eager for freedom, we are eager for justice, social justice, and a democratic constitutional state. We see Egypt as a democratic country.
And he said the Egyptian people should be free to choose for themselves. How do you think he actually governed? And let's just remind everybody that Morsi was on trial for espionage. Yep. He faced charges of terrorism, breaking out of prison.
Well, some of these charges are ludicrous. I mean, how, if you're the president of the state, how you can be charged with spying for another state slightly escapes me. However, I mean, there was a reason I was asked to chair this this review, which was that I was one of the, I think, possibly the only European politician to be in, to visit the Muslim Brotherhood leadership in Rab al Adawiya in July 2013. I went twice.
This was after the crackdown by the government?
This was after the coup, but yes. Whilst the demonstrations were still were taking place, and one was able to go in and out of the demonstrations and meet the people there who were demonstrating and get a sense as to the, of the demonstration and also get a sense of the people there. And I obviously come from quite a conventional political background. I also had quite a long time to learn about the politics of the Middle East. And one already sensed this extraordinary division in Egyptian society between those people who were supporting democracy and their the Freedom and Justice Party government on the one hand, and those who saw it as a deep threat to the long-term future of Egypt. And somehow this obviously needed to be reconciled. And the irony in all of this is actually if the Freedom and Justice Party had taken the advice of President Erdogan, who went to lecture in Cairo, I think in 2012, and then was greeted as a great by millions of Egyptians, I think, as he arrived. And then the sum of his lecture was that Egypt should go for a secular constitution. And I think if they had gone down that path, they would then have put much of the anxiety and concern of other Egyptian citizens to rest. So those concerns existed. Of course they did. But we then have to remember that his administration was handicapped from the start because it never had the cooperation of the military and it had effectively the police, as I understand it, simply downing tools on the Morsi administration whilst they were there.
Why does this matter now that obviously President Morsi is now dead? It says a lot about democracy and you have an increasingly authoritarian Egypt. Harking back, many in Egypt say, to worse conditions than under President Mubarak, whose regime and reign led to the Arab Spring in the first place. What is the crux of this issue for Britain, for the United States, for the democratic world?
Well, I think it's a test of our values. And the British administration and the American administration, when Morsi won 51.3% of the vote of what it was, then had to say to the Egyptian military establishment, this guy's won, and you are going to need to accept his government. And then they made it very difficult for his administration to govern. I think issues like power cuts and the rest and support for the civil administration, so much of which in Egypt is in the hands of the military. It's a vast chunk of the economy is controlled by the army, that it was made pretty difficult for his administration to work. He probably didn't react in the right way. He then narrowed the base of his administration during a time he was in charge and then began to select governors of provinces who were very closely aligned with the Brotherhood. And that obviously reinforced the anxiety of people who were worried about the constitutional future of Egypt. And then, of course, there was an argument over the constitutional court and the judges that were on it. And obviously, these are all judges appointed in the Mubarak era. So you can see the difficulty with which that fledgling democratic administration had to operate. And that's the disaster here, is that it wasn't able then to establish itself for the medium term. And the key thing here is they should not have been able to subvert the constitution to make it an Islamic constitution and carry out some kind of coup in that sense, where, like Iran, has been turned into effectively a theocracy. And tragically, everybody failed the test in Egypt.
Can I just switch conversations? They're slightly related, but not really. You're a Tory MP. We're in the middle of a Brexit crisis and a leadership contest right now. As I said, you're in foreign affairs. The former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson looks to be a front runner. Mm. But he has his share of critics in Europe. People say he didn't do a very good job as a consensus builder, being prepared as a foreign minister. He's talking about leaving, deal or no deal. What is on the horizon, do you believe, after this contest is resolved?
Well, one of the reasons why Boris is so far in front is that he is determined that we're going to leave on the 31st of October. And for the Conservative Party, who won the election in 2015 on the promise of a referendum, we enacted the law for the referendum in 2016, promising that this would be the decision that was going to either have us remain or leave the European Union. And to everyone's surprise, the electorate then voted to leave, and we promised to implement that decision. And 3 years later, following another general election in 2017, when we all promised we would, both the Labour parties and the Conservative parties, were all elected on a mandate to deliver Brexit, we haven't done so. So that basic breach of faith with the electorate is now undermining Conservative credibility. And so the sine qua non is that we have first base, in baseball terms, means that we've actually got to get that delivered.
Deal or no deal?
Deal or no deal. And of course, those terms are misleading anyway. There are already a barrowload of arrangements that have been made if we leave with no withdrawal agreement. And the deal, of course, if there's no withdrawal agreement, are World Trade Organization terms, plus all the understandings that have already been reached between the European Union and the United Kingdom about how things would operate in the absence of the withdrawal agreement as negotiated.
Unsettled times here, there, and frankly everywhere. Crispin Blunt, thank you very much indeed for joining us tonight. So let us look deeper into the intersection between faith, culture and politics. Our next guest, Rami Youssef, is of Egyptian descent, where over 90% of the population is Muslim. As a first-generation American, the comedy star is bringing his Arab and Muslim heritage to American TV screens with his new show, Rami. Here's a clip.
I want to know who I am. I want to explore.
You're like the kids in Egypt. They throw down the government. Big revolution. Then what? No plan.
I don't know what I'm doing, man. I look at my parents and how strong they are and how they just know everything's going to be okay because they have God.
While there are parallels with his own life, Youssef told our Hari Srinivasan that the show is not autobiographical, but rather a reflection of his community.
All right, so the character, Rami Youssef, who is he?
Oh, man. Well, the character on the show is Rami Hassan, and he's different from Rami Youssef.
Okay.
Yeah, he doesn't...
You're Rami Youssef.
I'm Rami Youssef.
He's Rami Hassan.
Yes. That last name change makes everything fictional.
Everything fictional.
Everything's fictional.
So when everybody on set refers to you as Rami, you're still thinking, no, I'm Rami Hassan now.
Yeah, I'm the character now, and none of those things are real. So let's be, you know.
Okay. I mean, is it that, is the premise, the interest of the show that he happens to be an Arab Muslim? Is it a coming of age story? When you're thinking about how to kind of truncate this idea and explain to people, what do you usually say?
It's a little bit of both. I think the thing that was always really interesting to me was I'd never seen someone who is from my generation openly dealing with faith in a way that felt honest. I was really fascinated by the concept that there's what you believe and then what you actually do. And there's kind of this space in the middle where you're trying to navigate it. Most of the stuff about faith is kind of like, oh, well, I'm leaving it behind. It's outdated. You know, my culture, my religion, I don't need it. I need to upgrade. And I never really related to that. That's not how my brain works. It's not what I believe. I've always been like, no, I believe in my faith. But I also am kind of pulled by my desires, by my ego, by, you know, whatever anyone could be pulled by to not be their higher self, right? Whether it's the faith you believe in or the idea you have of who you should be.
Yeah.
And so what does it look like to have a character in a really human way dealing with that in the context of an Arab Muslim family? Mm-hmm. And I think seeing someone deal with that honestly is probably the most humanizing thing you could do for a group of people that have never had the human treatment.
Yeah. So there's a clip early on that helps establish that. This is with you and your mom in a car, and you're starting to talk about dating and marriage a little bit. Let's take a look.
Rami, Do you want to stay alone forever?
Mom, you can't just walk up to a Muslim girl and, like, start spitting game or something. Like, what am I supposed to say? Like, hey, can I get your father's number?
Yes, why not?
Did that happen to you in your life? Ever?
No, my parents have been pretty relaxed about pushing it.
Yeah.
Which is that's a Rami Hassan difference, right?
Yeah.
I think his family on the show looks a little bit more like some of the Arab families that I grew up around.
Yeah.
Less so exactly my family.
So this is kind of informed by conversations 100 times with your friends and family
members.
Yeah,
and looking at the community and it's also kind of informs, you know, even though I haven't had that conversation with my mom, the conversation I have had with myself is, you know, who am I going to end up with? What does the next generation look like if I do believe in my faith and if I am trying to preserve my culture? Do I want to make sure I'm marrying someone who speaks the same language as me? Mm-hmm. Do I want to have a family that practices the same faith? Do I want to switch it up? These are all questions that you don't think you have to answer until all of a sudden you have to right now. And watching a character deal with that and realize that he needs to, you know, be a leader, even whether it's within a community or just his own family, he's got to grow into himself.
These are kind of sort of textured and nuanced insights into people that right now it seems that we lack when we are watching portrayals of Muslims broadly in Hollywood on television, right? We seem to have the kind of generic trope of terrorist on the one hand, and then we're slowly easing into kind of a very tame and perhaps safe version of a Muslim that we can see. And you're kind of not in either of those buckets. You're sort of trying something new.
Yeah. I think we're rooting it in something that I, again, find to be more real. It's not real to all Muslim experiences. Yeah. I mean, most Muslims in America aren't Arab. They're black or South Asian. And so this was, for me, an attempt to be very specific. I think most of the time when we see these portrayals, they feel more like apologies than representations. They're more, hey, look, we can be safe, or we can be just like you. And we kind of discarded that dialogue and more so threw a character in who's really trying to figure out, you know, his own agenda, and it doesn't really matter what the external things are.
There's an entire episode kind of around 9/11, or at least 9/11 is one of the events in that episode. Is that kind of a demarcation line for most Muslim Americans, or maybe even Muslims around the world, a pre-9/11 era and a post-9/11 era?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whether you want it to or not, I mean, on one level, it's a demarcation for all Americans.
Yeah.
It's just so horrifying, and it was something that I think was so performatively watched, and for people who lived close to New York, not only felt with the television performance of it, but the real-life impact where you just know people. So that in and of itself is a demarcation. And then you add the layer of, in the story we explore, being a child. Who, when a child is 12 or 13, that in and of itself is a demarcation, where it's like, oh man, I'm now growing into what is my adulthood, my sexuality, puberty, all of these things.
Yeah.
And then the added layer of, oh, is the faith that I have, is the sound of my name responsible for the worst thing I've seen? And so really that episode is all those things colliding. It's the overall human level. It's the being a kid transitioning into a teenager, and then it's this level of our culture and our faith being pinned as the reasons for it, and how that shifts an entire community.
What do you remember from your real life? I know you wrote an episode, and I don't know how much of it is exactly what happened to you, but what do you remember around that day and then the weeks surrounding it and kind of teaching yourself about maybe how America has changed?
I remember most actually just the self-doubt. You know, I remember just seeing people who look and are linked to your heritage and your belief. And when you are a kid who is afraid and you are growing up in a place that you are not part of the majority culture, you can turn on yourself. And to me, that is the conversation that's always been missed for me, is how it affects kids, but also the way that we eventually stereotype ourselves. So things happen and we distance ourselves, from our families, from our faiths. And so that, for me, I remember kind of planting those seeds and then me later kind of pushing against that narrative and stepping towards embracing it and realizing that those things weren't true. But it was such a process. And so that episode really just captures that initial shock, that initial fear from a different perspective.
You mentioned this earlier, but there's a lot of talk about faith, and that's actually something we just don't actually see, whether it was about Islam or about Christianity right now in Hollywood today. And this was very intentional on your part that there's a strong kind of religious through line.
Yeah.
It's not just your questioning, but it's almost like a character in the all the episodes.
Yeah, I think the presence of spirituality and God is a character throughout the episodes. And I think that we wanted to make it specifically Muslim. Mm-hmm. You see me praying in that manner. You see me at the mosque. But it's also kind of removed from Islam. And it really, it's talking about spirituality, which I think also gets missed out in the conversation. So much of it is about, well, I'm Muslim and I'm this type of Muslim, or I'm Christian, I'm Jew. We kind of talk about religions, but we don't talk about religion. Or we talk about the rules and we talk about the negatives, but we don't even talk about what the goal is. It would almost be like talking about basketball and only talking about fouls. And technical fouls. Right. It's like, wait, why aren't we talking about like slam dunks and alley-oops? Like, there's all this cool stuff about the sport that we don't even get to.
Right.
You know, we're just focusing on the infractions.
Yeah.
And so this steps out of, you know, only focusing on that and looks at someone striving for that bigger picture.
And there's also, it also lends itself to some very funny comedic moments. There's a clip from a mosque that I want to take a look at.
Man, bro.
What are you wearing, bro?
What
is this? I mean, seriously, you look like Muammar Gaddafi.
It's a galabiyah, bro. I
know it's a galabiyah. I love galabiyahs. Nobody's talking about the galabiyah. I'm talking about you in this galabiyah.
It's a little bit short,
it's
right?
It's short. It looks like a Muslim miniskirt for a man. I mean, it's really too much.
Why are you wearing a tracksuit?
It looks dope. Don't be jealous, okay? Run DMC, baby. Run DMC all day.
You look like a Russian basketball coach.
Leave my tracksuit out of
this. I think I look good.
Yeah, you look good.
Yeah.
For a six-year-old girl, she's gonna ruin this whole meeting. I mean, it's very frustrating.
What meeting?
Yalla, zabat al-safuf. Straighten the lines. Fill in the gaps, ya jamaah.
Allahu Akbar.
Allahu Akbar.
Allahu Akbar. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. Malik Yawm Al-Din.
I mean, it might now go down in history as the first visualization of a joke that happened in a mosque, right? Because we've only ever seen people very, you know, religiously this moment. They're having this.
I never thought about it.
I mean, I've never seen. And even when you look at, like, the portrayals of churches, it's very austere and people are in penance. And
I mean, reframing a mosque is such a goal of the show.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize how important it was until we made the pilot. Yeah. So when we first made the pilot, it didn't open up the way it does now. Right now it opens up with the scene we looked at earlier of my mom and I in the car.
Yeah.
It used to open just at the mosque. And when it did, you know, they take these new shows before they make the rest of the season, they throw them to test audiences and say, hey, what do you think of this? And so test audiences watching it. For the first 10 minutes, because we started at the mosque speaking in Arabic, they thought the show was most like a drama in the vein of Homeland. So they thought the show with me in a mosque was about terrorists. And it took them 10 minutes until I was on a date with a girl named Chloe to realize, oh, no, this could be a comedy. You know, I mean, it took that long because they saw a mosque, they heard the call to prayer, and almost universally the testing put it in the category of a drama and a terrorist drama. And the fact that this place that can be such a place of refuge, and we see in the show, this is a place where people go to solve their problems, a place where people go to commune with each other and to celebrate and to like worship together, is only framed in one other way, because we've only ever seen someone say Allahu Akbar and then a detonator go off. You know what I mean? And so the reframing of that, and to even have a joke like that and even have interactions like that, are a huge goal of the show. And so many people who've seen it are like, I've never even seen the inside of a mosque. You know, and the fact that they get to see it this way is really exciting to me.
One of my favorite episodes in it was around the mother's character, who's a fantastic actress. I mean, she pulled that off brilliantly. And then there's another one that you have around the sister. And you discuss kind of, you know, their sexiness, what's allowed culturally, their roles. And then also just at a very core level, the kind of double standard that exists for women
in these cultures or even in society in general. Let's take a look at a clip.
Ma, where are the keys? I can't find them.
Where are you going?
I'm going out.
Habib, Habibi.
Yeah, I gotta go, though.
At least take some baklava with you, okay? Yeah, you'll be hungry later.
Baklava's filled with sugar.
No way.
Yeah.
It's natural. It's honey from bees.
There's honey.
Yeah. The keys are in my purse. Near the baklava. Oh.
Okay, I'm going to Fatma's tonight.
Again, Dina? This is the second time this week.
I'm 25 years old. Why is there a limit? Does anyone even care where Rami goes? You guys never ask him where he is.
He just told me he's going out.
That's what I just said.
He literally gave you no information.
Yeah, I'm gonna go. Love you, Mom.
Love you, Habibi. What time are you coming back?
I don't know.
Okay, I'm leaving.
Okay, Dina. Just don't be late.
Yeah, Mama Habibti, please, text me when you get there.
Okay, Mom.
Okay, stand this way. Please, soft on the driving. Careful with the brakes.
Okay, Mom.
You ever get pushback from the Muslim community at large? You know, because as an Indian, if you try to go do stories about in India, like, oh, why do you want to show the poverty? Why are you looking at the bad stuff? Why aren't you painting us in a better light?
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult in general to even say the Muslim community, right?
Right.
Because, again, there's so many.
So many different.
Yeah, so we're going at it from so many different points, so many different points of view. I would say Arab Muslims, there's been a little bit of that, of why are you showing us like this? But I would say there's also been a resounding feeling that I felt from that community in particular of, oh, man, this is us, and being really excited. And in other Muslim communities feeling, well, this has nothing to do with me, and this isn't my story. And so there's that range, but there is kind of this thing of why are you showing those things and why are you displaying them? And I think that, again, that's kind of the job of a show like this.
I also read that you've really worked hard on trying to, whether it's the staffing of the writer's room, whether it's the casting, trying to find people that are appropriate to the part who understand what it is that they're writing in the first place.
Yeah, it's really important to inform those conversations in a really good way. And we've done it by hiring writers, by hiring consultants, by making sure the actors we employ are, you know, people who could maybe be close to the experience, but certainly when we're dealing with stuff that has actual Arabic for an Arab role, someone who can speak it.
One of the most interesting characters that I see in the series is Steve Way, who is in real life one of your best friends, and is the best friend of this character. Let's take a look at a clip.
This Muslim Tinder is awesome. Dude, why'd you swipe no on her? Just swipe a no on all the girls that have scars.
Dude, no, it's just, she's not my vibe.
You're racist.
How is that racist? Headscarf's not a race. It's something that people wear.
Oh, I love when they're all covered from their head to their toe like that. Yo, that mystery is sexy.
That's disgusting.
Have you ever dated a Muslim girl?
No, I haven't. And that's why I'm doing this. I'm trying to meet someone, you know, different.
Because you're racist.
How is that racist, dude? Islam is not a race. It's something you believe in.
You know, it's just one of these relationships, actually, it makes you realize that we don't see people like Steve on TV.
No.
Hardly ever.
No, you don't. I mean, it's really hard to pin actual disabled actors playing disabled roles. I mean, you should hear Steve rant about Drake on Degrassi. he'll give you a great 10-minute speech about it. But yeah, it's really obviously something that, again, the accuracy of putting people who are actually the thing when you do it on screen.
Yeah.
And for me, this is a real life relationship with Steve. Not that the things that happen in the show are real, but you know, he's been a friend of mine for so long, and in many ways, our differences in many, you know, obviously they're different differences, but being different together has been a huge part of our relationship. And so showing that on this show, when I had this opportunity to have this show, was really important to me, because he's one of the greatest comedians that I know, and I see all comedy, I'm involved with it, but he doesn't get an opportunity to be seen just because of really practical things. I mean, if you try to go to a comedy club in New York,
downstairs.
I mean, if you're a patron, you can barely get in. You know what I mean? Like a walking patron with two. I mean, it's these tiny little clubs, and they're amazing, but someone like him doesn't get there, you know, doesn't get to do it. And so how can we give him a platform, and how can we get into his story?
Speaking of stand-up, when's your HBO special drop?
On June 29th.
Okay, and, yeah. And how long did that take to put together?
It's a collection of stand-up that I've been doing for the last 7 or 8 years. I mean, some jokes are from that first year, and then some jokes are from 2 weeks before I shot it. Yeah. And it really is a companion piece to the show. I think a lot of it is a long, you know, kind of a long-form talking explanation of certain bits and certain things. And yeah. It's really personal, and it also can be a little bit topical. So it covers a couple things from this year, but also really spans into stuff that I think if you've seen the show or if you haven't, will integrate, you know, pretty fully.
Rami Youssef, congratulations.
Oh, thanks, man.
And looking forward to season 2. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. And thanks for watching.
And the comedian Rami Youssef trying to make a space for everyone with his new show, Rami. That is it for now. Remember, you can always listen to our podcast and see us online at amanpour.com. And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832. And tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.